Today, questions, answers, and a soft landing, maybe. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, it's an unofficial Friday. It's Thursday, but Tarek's with me. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Very good. Day early, but good to have a conversation about what's going on.
Oh, definitely, mate. There's certainly a lot going on at the moment, and I think everything's just transpiring so fast. You know, it seems like just a few weeks ago, there was a lot of people talking about, you know, inflation coming down, disinflation this, disinflation that, and then, you know, we got the US CPI and retail sales numbers, and all of a sudden, things have changed, you know, quite dramatically.
Well, this is very interesting, and of course, I think those US CPI numbers were significant, not only, of course, because they did change the basis of some of the allocations, but also because it really does question the narrative of, you know, inflation's coming down, the Fed will be able to turn turtle. Now, of course, the Fed's talking about more rate rises, and the markets are getting a bit sort of shifty. But it's interesting because, of course, depending whether you're a bull or a bear, you're going to actually go after different numbers, right? Because there were a few more positive bits within it. But overall, I think the negative side probably holds true. And the markets are now getting a bit jittery about, well, how high will rates go? Same discussions here in Australia.
It is, and I think what's interesting and something that we'll explore later on in the show is just at the end of the day, the RBA is going to be dragged along by the Fed. If US inflation remains high and the Aussie economy doesn't tank into oblivion, we are going to be dragged along with the Fed. You know, like historically, the maximum spread between Aussie and US rates is about 1.4%. So realistically, you know, if the Fed takes it to 5.5, 5.6, as some commentators and investment banks have been suggesting over the last 48, 72 hours, then, you know, 4% cash rate, 4.1, 4.2, well and truly on the table. And that's something that we've seen even recently from NAB, which is weird, you know, considering that for the longest time it's been low rates, low rates, low rates, and now we've got one of the big four talking about a cash rate north of 4%, which is... Well, it's going to cause some problems. Let's just put it that way.
Well, I think the problems are already there to be seen. The unemployment rate, of course, was higher reported today, although what we'll discover if we go into that is that, again, it's to do with these, you know, the survey in, survey out. The numbers coming in were actually worse because the participants were worse. So, you know, it's another number, Wang.
It is. I mean, you know, 3.4% in the sample group that was rotated out, 4.2% unemployment in the group that was rotated in. I mean, I'm not sure, but that might be the biggest gap that we've seen in between two sample rotations. So, you know, I wouldn't put too much stock in that info. It's just one data point. And ironically, even ANZ made that point in a note today, and they said that they expect, I believe the word they used was robust jobs growth in February, and for that to be reversed. So,
yeah. Well, it's the old number weighing effect, because it's basically the way the survey is done now on the small sample sizes, it really distorts it, so nobody quite knows where we are, which is an interesting, and we'll do some Q&A as well today, I think, because there's a lot of questions that people chucked at us, so we'll try and do a bit of that too, right?
Yeah, definitely. You know, do you want to get started? I've got a little bit about Kiwi housing prices. I thought people would like that little routine update, then we can move on to the questions.
Great. Okay, well, let's go with this first, because I love this one. I predict a soft landing if the chute opens. That's great.
Well, we're just going to have to wait and see, aren't we? It's going to be interesting. If you guys want to have a look at the charts, or if you want to find out what the source is, I usually source all charts, if humanly possible, if I can remember where I found them in the first place, at avidcom.substack.com. And I got a few donations in my inbox this morning, which I was very pleased about. And I would just like to say thank you to those of you who have contributed. And we'll get on to the data. Now, this is from the peak of Kiwi housing prices, which in most markets most big markets was November 2021 for Wellington. It was October 2021. And just for a bit of flavor, I have put in the US housing crash from the start of the global financial recession, which also I might add very much now includes the precipitous drops that began after Lehman Brothers collapsed. So we've seen prices down in Wellington by almost by around about 26%. We've seen prices nationally fall more than 15%, and Auckland is now down almost 22%. So it's getting interesting, to say the least, because not that long ago, we had all the major banks in New Zealand saying, you know, housing price falls are going to be contained. They're going to be contained. It's going to be only, you know, 10%, maybe 15%. And now we've already passed 15%. And, you know, you've got the RBNZ talking about taking rates to 5.25%. And there was a note out from the ANZ's branch in New Zealand the other day talking about a peak RBNZ cash rate of 7%. So if the Fed does drag things a lot higher, well, things are going to start to get really, really interesting for the New Zealand housing market, particularly considering that Wellington is only a hair's breadth away right now from hitting the same point as the US housing market did nationally following the global financial crisis.
I think the other thing about the New Zealand data was just the low number of sales and the massive growth in listings, not new listings, but just the stale listings. So very few people are actually buying property at the moment. So that's another reason why you would expect prices to continue to drift down. And I think the point that you make about decisions in Australia and New Zealand are not actually made just within Australia and New Zealand. It is ultimately what the Fed does. We're so anchored to what the Fed does. And if Fed goes higher, we're going to have to go higher too. So, you know, that 7% number, although it sounds pretty painful, and as you say, it would be pretty chronic, it's not totally out of the way if, in fact, the Fed goes as aggressively as many people think they might.
No, I agree. And I think that it's interesting that we are seeing this divergence at the moment between Australia and New Zealand, because naturally New Zealand is further down the cycle than we are. They've seen housing prices fall significantly more than we have, although not that much more. I mean, our prices are down 10% at a capital city level. Theirs are down 15%. So we're not really that far behind in the grand scheme of things. But what is interesting is how there's been the divergence in terms of stock on market and listing numbers. Because in Australia, stock on market is still highly, highly depressed. We're still 20% below the five-year average. And considering the fact that the last 5 years includes COVID, and also the 2017 to 2019 downturn in housing prices, that I think speaks, you know, some quite strong volumes. But I guess the question is, and this is something you've explored recently with Edwin in your Monday rants, you know, at what point does that begin to change? At what point do we start to see these listings come onto the market? And, you know, the market, because right now, I mean, we've seen housing turnover collapse to well below the five-year average, you know, and that's a five-year average impacted by COVID, etc. So, you know, how long is it going to be until we start to see that even low levels of listing numbers start to, you know, mount up in terms of high levels of overall stock on the market?
Well, it's a good question, because there were some interesting observations today about the number of negative equity properties now, you know, appearing, 100,000 plus. And we also know that there are people who are actually now in distress, and just so distressed sales are beginning to just tick up a little. And so those two factors together could well actually indicate that we're going to see a change in the weather with regard to listings, because, you know, people at the moment are sitting on the sidelines saying, well, I don't have to sell, so I'm not going to even try and sell because prices are falling. But that may change. And interestingly, still some property investors are being forced to sell because the interest rate rises mean they can't service the mortgage they've got, because they can't put the rent up enough to be able to cover the differential costs of the higher mortgage repayments. So that's where some of the listings are coming from at the moment. And a lot of those properties are actually older properties that have not been well renovated or indeed cared for, and would not actually comply with the current legislation relating to investment properties, which is another reason why people are selling.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, because, like, you know, there's this idea that landlords can continue to pass on all the rising costs to renters. Yet if we stick with the New Zealand example, for the average New Zealand mortgage holder who was on a variable rate, and a lot of them were on lower fixed rates, so in actual fact the reality is probably quite significantly worse. But let's just stick on variable rates. They've seen that the cost of their mortgage repayments, not just the interest repayments, their mortgage repayments as a whole, rise by 49% in the last 12 months. Now, Auckland rents, according to the rental index, have risen in December. It was zero year on year. And more recently, it's 2.5% year on year. And that may be an issue with seasonality, but let's just give it the benefit of the doubt and call it 2.5%. So they've been able to absorb 2.5% of that rising cost when their costs are probably up, you know, what, 45% in total, you know, because of the cost of the mortgage? And it's just, it just goes to show that you, that, that the idea that you can just keep passing on the cost, keep passing on the cost, and, you know, that, that investors are going to get bailed out by rising rents, it just, it doesn't add up. Rents would need to rise just incalculably further than they already have for that to be viable. And I just don't think that's particularly realistic. Although I will say that Australia is not New Zealand, because we've got Albo ramping up immigration to the moon, which is obviously going to put, you know, additional upward pressure on rents in Sydney and Melbourne. Now, admittedly, it's to a much lesser extent in most of the other capitals, but it is a factor in particular in those two cities.
And of course, the proposal from one of the parties in Australia, New South Wales in particular, is, well, why don't you get some people with properties with spare rooms to let those rooms to younger people, and maybe we'll have an app that we can connect people together. So they're looking for all sorts of weird ways to try and solve this rather intractable problem.
Well, I mean, the thing that gets me is there are some, you know, rather sort of simple things that they can do to sort of alleviate this. I mean, making sure that not having 10% of properties, it's roughly 10%, but about a million properties empty, yep, on census night is obviously a factor.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I think it's worth putting into perspective as well that, like, that is not normal in a lot of Western countries. Like, if you look at, say, for example, I was looking around Europe at their data recently. In Germany, it's about 4% of properties are empty on census night, yet for us, it's 10.
Yep.
Now, I think, I mean, you know, you could sort of make an argument, oh, it's the issues with rural areas, rundown properties. And admittedly, that is a factor. But I think that it's also just a bit, I don't know, it's just a bit out there that we do have such an issue in that regard. And I think just to go back to the issue of Albo's migration and just migrants and foreigners buying Australian property in general, you're not adding anything to housing stock if you buy the property and it sits there empty doing nothing.
Yep.
Which is something that, you know, quite a few people, you know, have raised that as a point. So, but, you know, no one really cares. So,
No. You know. Well, you know, if you go around Docklands, some of those high rise areas there, you know, you'll see that there's a lot of stuff that's never been lived in. It's being held empty. They're just sitting there rising. Rising the prices and seeing the prices rise and just enjoying the equity growth. And they don't want to let them out because they won't be new anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit ridiculous, but I mean, by the same token, you know, I mean, it's like I was saying, you know, to someone on Twitter last night, you know, we've got a government that is afraid of touching superannuation tax concessions for the very small percentage of people who have over $5 million. Now, the stated purpose of superannuation is to give someone a secure retirement. Now, I think capping tax concessions on balances under over $5 million is a fairly sort of fair thing, because I tell you what, I think I could retire pretty bloody comfortably on $5 million.
Absolutely, even with inflation raging, right?
Yeah, even with inflation raging. I mean, yeah. You know, you can whack it in all sorts of different businesses, shares, yeah. You know, even just a term deposit. I mean, you whack that in at, what, 5, some cases 6%, 300K, I could live. three times the median household income in Australia, well, actually more than three times. I think somehow one person could retire on that. And then there's potentially the missus with another $5 million. So they're all set.
I know. Yep, the distributional problem, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we should, rather than, you know, me going on one of my rants, we should probably move on to the questions.
Go on then.
All right. Okay. All right. Common Ground asks, amidst persistent upward pressure on rents, what macroeconomic or policy factors can potentially serve as a brake on curbing the escalation in the cost of rents? We'll start with you, Martin.
Oh, well, the easy question first then, that's easy, yeah? So obviously there's a supply question, right? So have we got enough property available to rent? And that is a big question. My own analysis suggests that it's a problem, and it's a problem for three factors. Firstly, about 20% of investors have already left the field, so they were offering property for rent, they now are not. Why? Because with interest rates rising and with the economics and with the legislative changes that came through to actually support fire alarms and other things that are required now, it just didn't make sense. So some property investors are leaving. The second point is that we know migration is massive. You know, the amount of migration, some people are now saying it could be 500,000 people over the next year. Huge number. So there's a significant demand coming in from that migration force. Now, that's a policy setting that Albo basically has allowed to happen. You know, it was actually a policy that could actually have been turned differently. And there's a really interesting question in my mind as to whether migration is something which should be looked at more seriously. So that would be something which we potentially could do. Third is, I think there's a big question about this idea of affordable housing. And, you know, whilst the Labour government announced this $10 million scheme, just look at it carefully, that's, you know, the money is, the $10 billion is going to sit there and they're going to actually invest it and get a return on it. And that return will then go to actually paying for some affordable housing. So it's a very small proportion. It's not going to help really that much. So they are still trying to use the standard economic model, you know, the neoliberal view, to try and actually solve the problem, which is insolvable, I think, that way. So those are some of the things that you might want to think differently about. The other point is worth just highlighting, that the reason that why people are renting is because housing affordability is shot to pieces. So if, in fact, house prices did come down significantly, people might actually make different decisions about renting versus buying. So in a way, the growing rental sector and the pressure on rentals is an outfall from the broader question of housing affordability, massive loans, of course, now the mortgage multiples much higher than previously. So it's part of this much bigger intractable question, which includes supply and credit and all those things. So those are some of the things that I'm sort of knocking around. I'm not sure there are any easy solutions in there, though.
No, there aren't. I mean, I think you're right. I think those are, you know, sort of what I would consider to be sort of slam dunk solutions to this particular problem. I mean, you know, naturally, I think, you know, reducing migration to a level more consistent with historical levels with a weakening economy would be wise. And that's something that we can, that I've got a chart for later on in the show. But I think you're right that we need a much more broad-based solution, something that looks at supply, something that looks at demand, something that looks at it in a much more grand strategy sort of
joined up thinking,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because I mean,
novel idea.
Well, look, I mean, naturally, the thing is, like, as things stand, no, we can't fix issues with housing prices because, I mean, well, we could, but you know, you'd hate to see what would happen to Albo if he tried that. But you know, just as settings stand today, I mean, I think that we need to cut red tape around building regulation. I think that we need to, you know, be able to let people, you know, basically build, you know, more homes. I think we need to, at the same time, strengthen standards on properties, because frankly, a lot of them are garbage, and you know, frankly, they wouldn't get over the line in a lot of other places in the developed world. They just laugh at you, and I just think there needs to be that sort of really sort of, like, as I said, grand strategy sort of solution where you look at all these different issues that are impacting the market, and just go, well, we could just flip this one switch, flip this. And just flip all these different switches into different settings that could help improve things. I mean, and naturally, on a more long-term, you know, viewpoint, you'd obviously add social housing to that mix. Because, I mean, realistically, to me, social housing is part of the social contract. Because there are people in life who are, for whatever reason, because of life circumstances, because they're bad with their money, because of whatever reason, they're never gonna be able to afford a property. Or they're never going to be able to get their act together to get a property. Now, them being homeless or them being some other form of drain on the state is not positive. You know, them being on the street, them getting sick, them turning to drugs, whatever it is. You know, a home, as many different Senate committees have found, is the bedrock of community. It's the bedrock of mental health. It's the bedrock of many, many different things. And I'm not saying just because you don't have a home that you've necessarily got these problems. Naturally, they don't. But a small percentage of people do, and those people cost the government a whole heap of money. So I think it would be more efficient, it would be more cost-effective to get these people into homes, even if they are basic, and get people off the street, get people out of you know, these other forms of accommodation, which are not necessarily conducive to positive development. So I think that, you know, and not only that, but that is how Australia has worked historically. Social housing was a huge part of Australia during our most, you know, prosperous times. And I don't think it's necessarily this whole socialist, Marxist, communist idea that some people seem to think it is to be able to do that. I think that it's just, you know, looking after your populace, the social contract, etc. And I mean, geez, just taking away superannuation tax concessions for those people with over $5 million would go a decent way to paying for a fairly significant social housing program. And let me put it this way, there'd be a heap more money for it than there would be from this silly approach that Labor's taking, that even the Greens oppose.
Yes. Well, that's right. The 10 billion sounds like a big number until you look at it, right? And the Greens, I think, are probably right to oppose it. But what we have, I think, is a certain amount of virtual signalling going on from Labor at the moment, but actually not much real action.
That sums up their government. In general, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, what are they doing? You know, I mean, oh, we care about the downtrodden, we care about renters, we care about carers and pensioners and everyone else. Oh, but we're gonna you know, ramp up immigration to the moon. We're gonna suppress wages growth. And it's like, well, great work, guys. I mean, you've literally got Lowe telling them that they're wrong. Although, did you see the other day that I think it was yesterday? He came out and he said that rents are decided by rental vacancy rates and not by interest rates.
Mm.
You know, and I think that was a slight little jab there at the government, that this is your fault. This is not on us.
Yeah. Now, that was an interesting observation. Of course, he earlier said that rents were a second-order impact and wouldn't go up very much at all. And, of course, he was quizzed on it. Actually, rents are going up very strongly. Why is that, you know?
Yeah, we don't have the greatest central bank governor in the world.
No, I think that's probably right. And he was able to duck and dive and weave quite significantly. I mean, they did bowl some quite good balls, but, you know, he played it back with a straight bat. But actually, the questions are still there, I think.
Well, I'm going to do something out of character here and say something nice about Phil Lowe, so prepare, everyone.
Okay, hold your breath.
Lowe has screwed up spectacularly. Let me preface by saying that, you know, he said, you know, all this stuff about rates staying low and all into 2024, etc. Now, he can say that he didn't, but that's irrelevant, because frankly, if that is how it's being perceived, then he needs to get on the television, he needs to do a press conference, he needs to get the media in there and tell everyone that they're wrong. But he didn't. And it's also the fact that his strategy of attempting to cap the 3-year bond yield at 0.1% also reflects the idea that rates were going to stay low until 2024. So, you know, you can come to their own conclusion there. However, Lowe is being torn to shreds at the moment. You know, Koshy went after him the other day on Sunrise. You know, he's getting torn to shreds by the government, by everyone. Yet, if you look across the Tasman to New Zealand, and you look at someone, say, like their governor, Adrian Orr, he said the other day in a parliamentary sitting, sorry, a parliamentary inquiry, basically, I am trying to cause a recession. Mm. I am going to drive the economy into the ground to tame inflation. Deal with it. Now, if Lowe said that, I don't think he'd be RBA governor anymore. So, really, I don't think that relative to what other central bank governors are doing, that he's really doing it in the here and now. Now, don't get me wrong, he screwed up spectacularly in the past, but in the here and now, that he's really doing anything all that wrong. And the thing that he's actually getting in trouble for is what he did in the past. What he's actually getting in trouble for is not what he did in the past, not all the screw-ups, not everything else. The thing he's getting in trouble for now is the fact that he's raising rates and he's making, you know, some of the stakeholders in Australia's economy rather unhappy.
You mean the stakeholders with investment properties?
Well, there are others, you know. I mean, there are. I mean, there are builders. Other people who don't like rising rates. But yeah, that's part of them. That's part of it. But yeah, I just don't think that some people are being terribly fair in that regard. You know, attack him for taking rates to zero. Attack him for the TFF handing the banks billions of dollars a year. Fine, go for it. I mean, you and I have done that more than a little bit, but. In the here and now, trying to kill inflation. I mean, if anything, he should be gone after for the fact that by the time this is all over, you know, inflation is probably going to have done more damage than anything else.
And it is worth just observing that inflation was actually already taking off before Ukraine, and even before actually COVID really started hitting. There were already signs. So then trying to turn around and say it was all the war's fault isn't very useful either, I think.
Well, I mean, there was the findings of that of the St. Louis Fed, I believe, the a couple of weeks ago, who said that, well, fiscal policymakers, probably more than a third of the inflation's their fault. So
exactly, and that was one of the Feds accusing themselves, really.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, the Fed knows that they screwed up. You know, they. I mean, there is at least some degree of realization on that. But by the same token, I don't think there's much from government. They just, put their hands over their ears and hum very loudly and just pretend that they didn't screw up.
Well, that's right. It's always somebody else's fault, isn't it? Let's get another question, shall we?
Yeah, we should. Is there any data on companies and businesses suffering mortgage stress? Now, naturally, this is something I have zero experience with, so I'll leave this one to you, Martin.
Yeah, the short answer is yes. So I run two sets of surveys, the consumer surveys, which are published every month and we discuss on the channel. I also run SME surveys, same cycle every month. But I started not publishing that data because it was clear to me that no one was very interested in it when I started. I used to publish it quite regularly, but it didn't really get much traction, so either on my channel or indeed on my blog. But the data is showing that small businesses are really under the gun. And when I say small business, I've really got a sort of a definition, which is, small to, one-man band up to, 10 to 15 to 20 million turnover or a bit more. So these are sometimes quite sizable businesses. And there are three things going on. The first is the cost of borrowing for the half of businesses that borrow, and that's a really big problem already. Secondly, they're often in the middle of the supply chain, so they're actually, their cost of input goods are going up dramatically, and they're having difficulty passing on the costs downstream to the businesses or consumers that are actually consuming because they aren't able to, so they're being caught in the middle. And the third one is that quite a few of them actually support their business on a property mortgage. So that property is effectively not only where they live, but also security against their business. And of course, we had a situation where the protections against going bankrupt were put in place around COVID. And that allowed people to trade insolvent, and basically we had very low levels of bad companies, people falling over. That was returned back over a little while ago. So we're now seeing a rush back of people actually getting into difficulty. And I was talking to an insolvency practitioner the other day who's saying, never seen it so busy. So we've got lots of businesses that are actually really struggling. In round numbers, about 40% of businesses in Australia in this SME sector are now cash flow strapped. But of course, the two things they have to pay are their mortgage and also the tax office.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Martin. It's good. It's interesting to hear that you're collecting that data and that we are seeing signs of stress there as well as with households.
Yeah. Well, I may choose to publish more data if there's a level of interest. So, folks, put a comment below if you're interested in more data on the SME sector. I have the surveys, and I can. It's just a matter of, is it worth it? Because if people don't look at it, it's not worth it.
Yeah, definitely. Let us know if you'd like to see an article or something on that, because it's definitely something that could be quite interesting to look at going ahead.
Okay.
Ash asks, Powell seems adamant in leaving rates high possibly into a recession to make sure inflation is dead before any chance of a pivot. Do you think the RBA has the same courage, or will political pressure have them pivoting and dealing with yo-yoing Australian inflation for years to come?
Well, let's just deal with the US. It's clear that the Fed is going to want to see rates higher. Pretty much all of them have come out of that. And I think you have to go back 20 or 30 years to understand that in history in the US, they were trying to deal with inflation, thought they got it under control, took rates down, it took off again. I don't think Powell wants to be known for a similar mistake. So I'm pretty convinced that he is deadly serious about pushing these rates higher until inflation is absolutely squashed. Now, if you come to Australia, Lowe is saying something similar. But there's a couple of differences, right? We have much more household debt, so our debt burdens are way bigger. We've got variable interest rates on mortgages more than the US, so that means it's more immediate in terms of the impact in the economy. And of course, the Reserve Bank mandate is about, looking after everybody and making sure the exchange rate doesn't wobble too much. There's nothing actually about inflation in the core mandate of the RBA, interestingly. So we might see a bit of a change earlier.
I think, I think that it's really going to depend on what ends up happening with low, really, because I think that deep inside low lives a hawk, similar to Powell. You know, both of them have written extensively on issues of monetary policy, on issues of bubbles, and both of them in their youth and in their younger years were very, very hawkish in terms of, you know, wanting to stop these issues before they arose, and it created so much systemic risk. Yep. So I just, part of me wonders if Lowe knows for a fact, once he figures out, you know, for certain, if he's going to, you know, potentially get removed and someone else is going to take over, which is, you know, currently the odds on favorite thing, you know, in terms of what analysts are hearing, is Lowe just going to revert back to his previous setting, his setting in his youth, and just be like, you know what, this is my last hurrah. I'm damaged goods in terms of, you know, my credibility, in terms of everything else. You know, it's going to be hard for him to get another job here in Australia, considering the way that he's sort of seen now by members of the public. You know, depending on what sort of job he wants, I think he's probably got a better shot probably in the US, maybe the UK. But what is there a possibility that he just goes, you know what, stuff it. You know, I'm going to kill inflation. And then someone else is going to have to deal with the mess anyway. So you can say, well, I did what I could to kill inflation, and then this other person came along and everything just imploded. It's not my fault.
Yeah. I think that's a point. I actually did an interview for News Radio yesterday, because I watched the RBA in front of the Senate estimates, which was quite amusing. And I actually made that same point. I think that, he will continue to plod through till September, probably not beyond then. But in a way, if he turns turtle now, he's going to lose even more face, isn't he?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, he's better off just, you know, I mean, Daniel, you know, the analyst Daniel DiMartino Booth, who's, you know, got quite a following on Twitter, she said in an interview about Powell, this was probably 8-9 months ago now, but she said only central bank hawks go to heaven. And only they get remembered and get a legacy.
Yes.
If he doves up now, and you know, or if he doesn't, you know, pursue inflation as hard as he should, you know, I think that's probably an even worse legacy than trying to be hawkish, to be completely honest with you, because it's just a bit of a flimflam man sort of thing, you know, that someone who's dragged along by circumstances, who's not really in charge of, you know, their own fate. Whereas if he sort of just keeps the hammer down, but not necessarily, you know, like in a super aggressive way, but I mean, if he just keeps raising, you know, 0.25, 0.25, 0.25, you know, for say like the next 5 or 6 months, that's going to be more than enough to sort of cement his legacy in a way. I mean, because realistically, I don't really see the Fed, acting more aggressively than that. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's a possibility. I mean, we are starting to see those inflationary pressures in the US reaccelerate. And yep. And the problem is that because Australian inflation is lagging, we are relying on data really from overseas to go, well, if their inflation is going to reaccelerate, there's a fairly good chance that so will ours. So, yeah, it's certainly a quandary.
Yeah, and there's certainly no evidence of inflation going away. I put a show out today saying in the US, the inflation is like a bad smell, you know, it's hanging around, right? Yeah. And I think that's exactly the problem. It's going to be hanging around for some time.
Indeed, and this sort of feeds into this question that James had. What is, analysts are saying that the RBA terminal rate could be less than 4%, while others are forecasting higher. What do you and Martin think?
Yeah, well, I don't think that a 3.65 or 8.5 is going to be sufficiently high to be able to actually deal with the inflationary pressures we've got. The latest data is showing more inflation, not less inflation, and the core numbers are not looking good either. And remember, we don't have housing in the CPI, so it's actually things like food and other factors. We had a bit of a relief from the petroleum going back, but that's sort of pretty much over now and is perhaps going the other way again. We've got power prices, which are going to continue to rise. Maybe not quite as fast and as hard as some people thought, but I still think are going to be significantly higher ahead. So there are still plenty of sources for inflation. And because the only lever that the RBA is using is interest rates, it means that they're going to go on lifting rates until inflation actually gets beat. So I think it's going to be a 4 or more.
Yeah. No, I mean, based on the settings on the data, that's where it should be going. And I mean, I think as well, it's also worth keeping in mind that we're going to be getting the first impact of the stage 3 tax cuts next year as well, which is going to be a fairly inflationary thing too.
Yes.
So, you know, you're going to have fiscal policy then pushing in the opposite direction, provided it's not pushing in the opposite direction at this year's budget, which is, let's be honest, there's a fairly decent chance of that
probably
happening.
Probably will, yep.
Yeah. But as for the broader question, I'm honestly not sure. Like I not that long ago, I was saying, you know, probably, you know, we've got about two hikes left. So probably like more like one now, but with the Fed with US inflation surprising to the upside and the Fed now taking rates higher, I think I'm just going to pull the chart up. I think that the long-term spread between US and Aussie rates is probably going to be maintained. And I will also add there's a major caveat here. If we see bond yields go for another run again, another run higher, particularly if we see new highs in things like US long bond yields, I could see them taking rates even higher here in Australia to protect the Australian dollar, because we've already got a dollar in the 60s, admittedly the high 60s. But if we start to see that divergence grow and we start to see the dollar go lower, which it could, if we start to see the Australian dollar can be a proxy for US risk assets. So if we see bond yields rise, risk assets sell off, then Lowe and the RBA have got an even bigger problem. They've not just got inflation, they've got the depreciating currency, which also creates more inflation.
Yep.
So as you said previously, the value of the Australian dollar is part of, you know, one of their main goals. So I think that there is a world in which Australian interest rates could go a hell of a lot higher than they are now if we do see that perfect storm. And in particular, I would also add that if we do see the Bank of Japan abandon or raise their yield curve target, that could really throw a spanner in the works if it comes at the wrong time.
Well, they announced the replacement, which will, I think, come in a few weeks' time in Japan. And I don't know much about the credentials as to whether they're going to like this shift, but it is interesting that there is speculation now that maybe the BOJ will go off in a different direction and basically, follow suit and do stuff which could actually have a very significant impact in Japan, but also on the international stage as well.
No, I agree. It's going to be. I think Japan is going to be one of the places to watch over the next 3 to 6 months for that reason. Okay, when do you think we will see pain and forced selling in the local housing market? Mid next year, later, or earlier?
Well, there's a little bit, as I said earlier on, a little bit going on already, but it's sort of not really apparent. Although, as I said, there was a report today that suggested some distressed sales are happening. It does take quite some time. So if you go through a standard process of missing payments, going 90-day in arrears, the bank then starts tic-tacking with you, trying to work out what to do, it can take 18 months to 2 years before that for sale effectively goes into a process that is a legal process where you have to serve notice and do all sorts of things to be able to actually then for sell the property. So that's at one extreme, so it could be 18 months to 2 years. But there's another type of forced sales, and that's where the particular household comes to a realization that their financial circumstances have changed, and so they actually are proactively then putting their property in the market and are looking to sell. And we know that quite a lot of that's going on at the moment. We know that the banks are having lots of conversations quietly with people about the fact that their circumstances have changed, and because of that, maybe they should think about selling. So it's a continuum between the two. The delinquency rates are ticking up slightly, but not dramatically. The latest from, I think, Moody and Fitch showed there's a little bit of a rise. Delinquency rates come before forced sales, of course, and there's normally a lag. So to my mind, it's going to be a year, 18 months before we really see the peak. But it does depend on where interest rates go. If they come back down, maybe people will get by. If interest rates payments are extended because the banks restructure and allow 35-year loans or interest only, that could give a bit of leeway. And of course, if in fact we start seeing then wages really taking off, now that would worry Lowe, because of course he's worried about the inflationary effects of wages growth. If wages start to take off, that might be another get out of jail card. So it's not baked in, but my sense is it's that sort of time frame that we should be looking at.
Yeah, I concur. I don't realistically think that in the sort of, let's say, the next 2 years that we're probably going to see many forced sales in terms of legally mandated forced sales, shall we say.
Yep.
But in terms of tapped on the shoulder, this isn't going to work, mate. You need to think about selling. I think that is going to be a factor that we are going to see. Probably, you know, I think we're probably going to start to see it more so in the next, you know, probably in the second half of this year.
Mm.
Because, you know, for the moment, I think as well that there is a really important psychological factor in all of this. Because as you said, that because if rates get cut, you know, and people get breathing room, or we see wages take off, or there's all these other sort of scenarios, admittedly not terribly likely scenarios right now without some additional downside. But there are these other scenarios in which, you know, you do get that get out of jail free card. Now, to go back to the example of New Zealand for a minute, the RBNZ has basically taken ideas that they're going to intervene in the market, chop them all up into little pieces and set them on fire. So they are not going to come to the rescue. That is, you know, that they have made that very clear. They said, we're going to cause a recession, deal with it.
Mm.
Whereas here in Australia, if you talk to a housing economist, you talk to an economist, you talk to analysts, they go, well, no, but the RBA is much more growth focused, which is, you know, another way of saying they're much more focused on not crashing the housing market into a tree. Because if it does, then it's going to take the economy with it. But that faith is broad-based here in Australia. That ALBO or APRA or the RBA, depending on the level of awareness of the individual household of these forces, is that they will come to the rescue. And I think that psychological factor is going to be the one that is going to decide how this plays out over the next 12 or 18 months. Because if people believe, if they continue to believe, that they, if they hold on, that they're going to be bailed out, that prices are going to go back to the moon and everything's going to be fantastic, then why wouldn't you hold on? Because it makes sense, because that is what has happened for the last 25 years. So there is precedent for that. But if there is something that finally drives people to go, you know what? The RBA isn't my friend. They're going to keep raising rates. They're going to keep rates high, and they're going to keep hurting my budget. So I need to, you know, get out of this. I need to, you know, walk away while I can. Then that will, I think, change the scope of things enormously.
No, I think you're right. The psychological aspect is critical. And in my surveys, I'm starting to see people begin to doubt whether, in fact, the Reserve Bank will save them, or whether APRA will save them. APRA said, well, we might reduce the buffer, but, you know, say 7% rather than where we are now, it's not going to make a huge amount of difference. And it will only be new loans. The real issue is all the existing loans that are there that were actually written at a much lower level, which are the ones where a lot of the pressure is. But, you know, from what we said earlier on, it's unlikely we're going to see interest rates drop. And it does then beg the question of the broader financial stability question, right? And that's the other angle here, because if, in fact, the banks start to get into difficulty with more 90-day plus delinquencies, they have to hold more capital. That then actually means that their profitability gets deteriorating even more. And CBA actually admitted that their margins were being crushed at the moment because of the way that the mortgage market was working. We might start to then see risks in the financial system begin to bubble up. And then the question is, at that point, would that change the game? Would that then force the RBA to do TFF version 2.0 or something like that to be able to prop up the banking system, because the banking system is propped up by the property sector? So it's a real mess, and I don't necessarily exclude the idea that we see some significant intervention just through COVID to prop up the banking system. So that's the other thing to watch, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think if things go bad, realistically, if things go bad, that's base case, right? Like, you know, if things really start to go downhill, Would you say that, like, you know, intervention is more likely than not?
I'm absolutely sure there will, because, you know, the banks basically have this implicit guarantee from the government. All the international investors in our banks assume that the government will always bail them out one way or the other, particularly the Big Four. And the Big Four themselves believe that they're too big to fail and too important to allow anything nasty to happen. So there is an expectation on many fronts that they potentially could be, you know, saved in some way or the other. Some of the smaller banks probably, you know, they might get consolidated into a play like BankWest and CBA last time around. So, but it really is an interesting question. I would say that this is a unique cycle where we've got so much debt. We had interest rates so low, we had house prices that ran through the roof, literally, and that's all now being reversed. And the speed at which this is changing is so fast that both the markets and the banks themselves and consumers as well are probably still trying to find their way through all of this. So that's why there's a degree of uncertainty about how this could play out.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you make a really important point about how quickly this is playing out. I mean, if we look at things, say, just purely from the perspective of the relative change in the way things are evolving in terms of, say, mortgage repayments and in interest rates in relative terms, this is by far the largest rate rise cycle in Australian history. You know, the largest rate rise cycle in Australian history, I believe, last time saw mortgage rates rise by about 58% is the largest, and that occurred over 6 years. Now, here in the here and now, we've seen mortgage rates more than double.
Yep.
You know, and they're potentially
in under a year.
Yeah, exactly. Double in under a year.
Yep.
I mean, you know, we've already taken, you know, the sort of average payable rate from somewhere around about 2.5%. At this point, it's heading up towards 6%. Now, that is a huge, huge, huge change. And, you know, people say, oh, but, you know, look at the way it caused, you know, like the late 1980s, early 1990s recession. And okay, rates were 17%, and obviously that was an extremely challenging thing. But in terms of the relative rate of change, they're increasing more now than they were then.
Yep.
So if that caused that recession, eventually monetary policy is going to drag on the economy, and it is going to hit the economy, and we are going to probably see some form of downturn or a recession, depending on what happens externally. But that, I then think, raises like a really interesting question. You know, like, what's going to happen then? Because we have a property market that hasn't had a proper recession in, what is it, 32 years, 33, or probably by the end of it, 33 years. So I think that's a really, really interesting question as to how all this plays out from here. Because if we do see a recession in the US or Australia or both or globally, how do things play out from there? Because the RBA can throw some money around and everything, but you still got to deal with a recession. So if you've got your job, it could be pretty good. But if you don't, or if you've got your hours cut, it could get pretty challenging.
Yeah, and you could end up with the old good bank, bad bank play, where basically you have distressed assets stripped out of the banks and held somewhere by the government, and they sort of manage them like that to sort of isolate the banks from the lending pressures that they would otherwise be under. I mean, I would say that's almost certain to be what would happen if, in fact, things went pear-shaped. But, of course, it takes a long time to work through that. If you look at the UK and Bank of Scotland, you know, they had a long cycle to sort of work through, and a lot of pressure, both from the government perspective and also from the bank itself. But structurally speaking, because the finance sector and the property sector is such a large chunk of Australia, you have to recognise that if, in fact, it went pear-shaped, that would have a huge impact on GDP, on economic performance, et cetera, et cetera. So it isn't, you can't isolate it from, you know, say, well, it's just the banks is over there, it's not a problem. It is structurally to the heart of the economy. And so you could see the economy really get into difficulty as a result, I think.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, even if you take out the economic multiplier effects, if you take equity mate out of the equation, the economy keels over, and you've got probably the worst recession since at least the 80s, if not earlier, if not since the Great Depression, once you factor in economic multipliers.
Yep.
So the question is does equity mate survive? Now, I mean, that's something I'm actually curious about. Have you seen any reduction in the proportion of borrowers seeking equity? you know, equity withdrawals when they refinance?
Slightly down a bit because the banks are being more coy about it. Because the valuations they're now starting to use on the properties are down, which means you've got less capacity to pull equity out.
That's very interesting to hear, because I was curious, because you know, I mean, up until recently we've only seen the proportion of people accessing equity just rise and rise and rise.
Yeah, it's beginning to plateau a little bit now, and that's partly because of the negative equity problem and the fact that the valuations that we're seeing are dropping. So I was talking to somebody the other day who works in valuations, and they've basically, depending on what property, they're sort of looking at a 10% lower valuation now from a mortgage market perspective. And I've heard stories where borrowers have begged the valuers not to downvalue their property, because if they downvalue the property, they can't then get the mortgage that they need to be able to actually survive in the property. And whereas previously valuers were sort of a little bit more flexible, it looks as though now the edict is, no, you need to be more realistic about the valuation. So we are seeing some falls in the equity that's available for Equity Mate to work in. And some banks, not all banks, but some banks are being a bit more cautious now about just pulling out more equity, particularly if there's not a huge amount of headroom there.
That's interesting. In the past, getting Equity Mate out has been like a relatively pedestrian process, but you're sort of seeing that now it's a lot more rigorous, and there's an actual like more of a serious valuation going on before, I mean, because I mean, from what I've heard from some people, before it was just like, oh, well, CoreLogic says it's worth this much, ergo, a certain proportion of that up to a certain level. So are they doing like more independent valuations now before they, you know, let people, you know, withdraw however much they want to withdraw?
Yeah, so it depends. So there are still situations where some lenders take over a refinance from the previous lender and they just take the valuation as given and just work off that. So there's no further due diligence about whether the equity's dropped or not. That's still happening, but it's less of a issue than it was, say, 2 or 3 months ago. But there are definitely now banks that are actually asking for more information and getting valuations for the refinance to confirm that actually the equity is sufficient, particularly if there's an equity withdrawal. Also, what we're finding is that the conversation about equity withdrawal is different from what it was 3 or 4 months ago. So 3 or 4 months ago, brokers would regularly encourage people to pull out equity, you know, as a way of managing their finances. It's not quite so strongly now advocated, simply because the game has changed. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Equity Mate dropping a bit, but it's still, you know, 60 billion is still a big number.
Wow. Well, that's interesting to hear, because, I mean, it's really the lifeblood of the economy, particularly for, you know, small businesses who can't access other forms of credit, as you were mentioning before about your SME surveys.
Absolutely. I think that's another indication of things are definitely morphing a bit. So.
All right. I think we've got time for one more question.
Yeah, go on. One more question. Yeah, good.
Okay. Dante asks, is it possible that the increase to net overseas migration adds to aggregate demand and increases inflationary pressures before productivity gains are realized that would counteract it?
You mean, is migration inflationary? It's a great question. The answer is yes.
Yeah.
So if you think about the broad definition of money chasing goods, right? Well, people chasing goods, people chasing property, right? If you increase migration, you clearly are going to develop inflationary forces into the housing sector, the rent sector, all of those things. And I would also say that quite a lot of the migration that's coming in, people are going into jobs that are actually often not particularly well paid. So there isn't necessarily a huge economic multiplier from those people. So whilst overall GDP might expand because it's just a bigger number, the GDP per capita may not expand, so you might not get any multiplier effect. So you actually might not get any economic benefit on a GDP per capita basis, but you might get significant inflationary forces coming through as a result of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you've pretty much hit the nail on the head there. I don't really have a huge amount to add to that. I mean, naturally, there is also, you know, there's also the fact that in the longer term, immigration will suppress wages. That's a point that even Governor Lowe himself made. I believe it was in September, October last year, talking about how the basically, I mean, what was the word he used? diluted. It dilutes wages, wages growth pressures.
And the Treasury did make the point that whilst they were forecasting wage growth of 4%, you know, in the immediate term, it was going to drop lower later, right? And that was partly the impact of those migrants that are actually flooding the market and businesses paying, you know, less as a result. So, yeah, I have a feeling that we will rue the massive turn up the spigot on migration strategy over the last few months in about a year to 18 months' time, because people will then realise just what it's done in terms of wrecking the economy.
The sad thing is that if you think about the last time there was a major, you know, I mean, realistically, Australia is heading for some form of economic downturn.
Yep.
That, I mean, that's pretty much like, even, you know, you've got the likes of the big four banks talking about growth in the second half of this year and into 2024, basically flatlining.
Yep.
So in per capita terms, we're having a recession. You know, for households, it's going to be recessionary. And at the same time, they're having their purchasing power crushed by inflation. So that's fun. But, and the problem is historically, last time we saw these types of pressures, you know what, I've actually got a chart for it. Last time we saw these types of pressures in the late 1980s, immigration fell and fell and fell and fell until it basically fell off a cliff to the point where it was about almost 1/6 of what it was previously. So realistically, that is what Albo and Chalmers and Treasury should be thinking about now. We should be thinking about limiting the number of migrants to a more sustainable long-term level, so when the downturn does arrive, it does less damage to the labor market, it does less damage to wages growth, and really just outcomes for everyday households. And I'm not suggesting that it needs to be absolutely slashed down to nothing. Migration can still be done at a sustainable level, just as it was done during the 1990s recession. But it needs to be done at that sustainable rate, that it's not going to undermine things significantly for the people who already live here, including the newly arrived migrants.
Well, that's very important, I think. And, you know, there is an international competition at the moment for migrants, right? Look at New Zealand, look at the UK, look at Canada, look at the US. Everybody wants migrants. But the economic consequences of high migration are not being factored into any of the thinking that I think is being done at the moment. And it's interesting because, the Treasury in their evidence to the Senate said, well, they've modelled, you know, a level of migration. And they've made some assumptions about the way that's going to flow. And I don't think they've necessarily thought about the downside, is what I'd say. I think this is a really important point. We're at an inflection point. Economy is going to be weaker. Migration should be tighter rather than looser.
Yeah, and I just add that there is nothing wrong with, you know, bringing, you know, I mean, Australia has always, you know, to a degree attracted the cream of the crop of migrants, because it is in a lot of ways a great place to live in relative terms. And, you know, if you are getting, you know, people in to help build new industry, to help innovate, to help, you know, further the cause of the welfare of the people of this nation, or even if it's just about people furthering the welfare of the people of this nation on a micro level, doctors, nurses, carers, that sort of thing. Naturally, sure. That, I mean, it's essential for the country.
Mm.
But if you look at the top professions of the people coming into the country in pure nominal numbers, it's not automation engineers. It's not, you know, it's not people who, you know, working in a lot of those fields in too many cases. I mean, like, I think 3 out of the top professions for migrants coming into Australia are accountants, chefs, and cooks. Yes, chefs and cooks are separate because reasons. Now, do we need that many accountants, chefs, and cooks? Or do we need more nurses? Do we need more people who are going to help innovate and help, you know, build a more prosperous future for this country? But that's really the issue. You know, I mean, I've got, you know, if people want to come here for a better life, that's great, but, you know, I think that it just needs to be all put into a broader context, just like it has been, and just like it has been debated for well over a century.
Absolutely. My mind went immediately to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I don't know whether you follow that, but there's a wonderful story as part of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on a particular planet, right? And they discovered that they'd actually shifted all the hairdressers and marketing people and, you know, all those useful professions, right? They'd throw them onto this other planet because basically people were so fed up with them. So there's an interesting question about the skill sets that we need for our future and whether, in fact, the migration programs currently are actually optimized or whether it really is just about bringing more bodies in so that we can have waiters in the cafes and bars, and whether we can have people picking fruit at low levels, and whether we can have traders building cheap houses. I personally think that the whole migration question has been muffed and muffed greatly, and I think we will regret it at our leisure. But unfortunately, of course, this is a core policy at the moment.
It isn't, but I mean, the thing is that people have been regretting the level of migration into Australia for almost a decade now.
No.
You know, sure. since the end of the mining boom and when it started suppressing wages. And I mean, realistically, are you not better off just taking the economic medicine, you know, taking the downturn, dealing with it, moving on, and then having, you know, moving back more strongly? But I mean, realistically, you know, we've, instead of fighting inflation hard, we've just destroyed, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if you saw Greg Jericho's chart today on Twitter. But, you know, even by the RBA's forecast of, you know, strong wages growth, by the time it's all over, you know, we're going to be running the economy on 2009 levels of real spending power per capita. And that's quite concerning.
No, it is. And wages growth still very weak and property prices lower. And so, the negative spiral is there. And that's why I've been talking about recession. I do think that the risk there now for us to see a recession in Australia. And there's a generation or two who've never seen it, and it's not pretty.
No, but it's also just part of life. Yep. You know, it's part of the normal cycle. I mean, you know, every 6 to 10 years, depending on the country, yep, is you have a recession.
Cyclical. And trying to push against it and trying to stop it, which is what they've been trying to do from a central bank perspective for the last 20 to 30 years, has basically created the problem that we've got, where we've got massive money supply increase, you know, all the other debt issues as well as the inflationary issues. And in a way, sometimes a cleansing recession is required to get the economy back into a more usable form for the next period. So it is part of the cycle. So maybe trying to resist it and maybe assuming that, you know, the central bank or the government will find a magic way through it is actually wrong, because what you do is you build up a bigger level of pressure for later, so that when this thing actually bursts, then the size of the burst and the impact of the burst is a lot worse.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, the thing is that I sort of see the way that policy has been conducted in Australia and throughout much of the Western world since the end of the global financial crisis in particular, as basically taking a time bomb and then diffusing it with an even bigger time bomb.
Yes, that's right.
You know, and then they just keep doing it and doing it and doing it until the cost just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yep.
And that's a problem, particularly here in Australia, because we haven't had a recession. We haven't had for want of a better expression, the bushfire to burn off all the dead wood.
Yep.
You know, the companies, the employees who otherwise wouldn't be employed under more normal conditions, but are just purely out of just inertia.
Yep.
And I mean, look, it's recessions are hard. They're challenging. But if they occur on a relatively regular basis, they're also relatively manageable. And if you use counter-cyclical fiscal policy, which is supporting the economy, you know, through that transition, they can also be relatively contained. But when you don't have one for 30 years, you just ended up with just an enormous time bomb. And I think that's why, you know, so many people just want to avoid the next recession so badly, because if it actually is allowed to play out, it's going to be challenging.
Yeah, well, the politicians want to push it over the next election horizon, right? At all costs.
Yeah, I'm honestly just tired of short-termism. I mean, I'd rather just a politician come out and say, look, this is what needs to happen. Yeah. Although by the same token, Keating did that and people still hate him for it. What is it, over 30 years later?
That's true. Tarek, very interesting conversation. Good Q&A. Thank you very much for all the people who threw questions in, and give us your feedback if you like the Q&A format. We'll do it some more, and we'll catch up for another yarn in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, sounds good, man. I'm looking forward to it.
Terrific. Thanks very much. See ya.
See you, mate.